It is Friday, September the 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, fixing Europe's refugee crisis won't be easy.
All of this is politically complicated. What Europe can do is exert pressure. It can provide political support for those that are trying to resolve the conflict. But I think we have to be clear on this. It will not happen soon enough to deal with the refugee problem that we face today.
Also ahead, remembering the September 2001 terrorist attacks on America, plus finding the early human ancestor. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The United States said Thursday that it will accept at least 10,000 Syrian refugees in the coming year and increase its humanitarian assistance for those who are fleeing the violence in Syria. That announcement came as thousands of refugees streamed through Europe, facing torrential rains on the Macedonian border with Greece and even farther north, where Austria halted train service with Hungary because of massive overcrowding from the refugees. We turn now to International Edition's Jeffrey Young for more on the refugee crisis in Europe.
Leon Begg is an associate fellow at Chatham House and a professor at the London School of Economics. In the face of a massive refugee crisis, there are people saying, why not stop it at the beginning? Why not do something to solve the civil war that's in Syria? And why not take action to stop the Islamic State? How practical is that suggestion?
It's unrealistic at the moment because we've been witnessing these difficulties, not just in Syria, but also in Eritrea since 2009. And I don't see an easy solution to this coming rapidly. Certainly, it's part of an overall solution. For Europe, dealing with the external source of the migrants is as important as dealing with the humanitarian tide that has crossed the Mediterranean over the last few months. But it isn't going to happen quickly.
What would you set forth as recommendations for Europe to do to address the problem at the source, the Syrian civil war and the Islamic State?
Well, they can only do this in collaboration with other countries in the international community. It will take U.S. influence. We also know that the Russians have been holding up the Syrian regime, and they've been reluctant to intervene. Turkey has its own doubts because of its conflict with the Kurds. So all of this is politically complicated. What Europe can do is exert pressure. It can provide political support for those that are trying to resolve the conflict. But I think we have to be clear on this. It will not happen soon enough to deal with the refugee problem that we face today.
How well prepared is the UK and the rest of Europe to take a flood of refugees, not just for a little while, but again and again and again, possibly for several years?
Well, the Europeans have been struggling to find a way of coping with this. The European Union is not a strong federal entity like the US federal government. It's an organization which is very much the sum of its individual countries. And many countries in Europe, for different reasons, are opposed to being generous towards immigrants. There's also a confusion in many European citizens' minds between immigrants who are refugees and therefore fleeing conflict and those who simply want to come to Europe to get a better life. Europe has not been able to find a formula to deal with this, which is the reason we see these images of confusion over the last couple of weeks. I think there will be a huge amount of pressure coming, particularly from the Germans, to share out the burden of coping with the migrants and not leaving it to the frontline countries, which are Italy, Greece, and Hungary. There will also be an enormous pressure on the police authorities across Europe, including the European equivalent of Interpol, Europol, to find a way of cracking down on the people smugglers who are causing so much misery.
Leon Begg is an associate fellow at Chatham House and a professor at the London School of Economics.
And many thanks to you, Jeff. International Edition's Jeffrey Young. Here in Washington, Democrats have blocked a Senate vote of disapproval on the nuclear accord with Iran. VOA's Michael Bowman reporting now the White House is hailing the move as a historic step forward and a victory for diplomacy.
Opponents of the nuclear pact fell two votes short of the 60 required to end Senate debate on a resolution disapproving the nuclear pact. The procedural vote followed days of impassioned floor debate about the deal and how Congress should address it. Republican Senator Orrin Hatch explained his opposition.
It is not a cavalier attitude about war that leads me to oppose this deal. It is my unwavering judgment that this deal makes war much more likely. Let there be no doubt. A deal that paves rather than precludes Iran's path to nuclear weapons capability makes war more likely.
Democratic Senator Tom Carper said Iran's nuclear ambitions will be kept in check.
We have the ability to know if they cheat. They cheat, we have the ability to put right back in place these same crippling economic sanctions. And if that doesn't do the job, we have other alternatives at our disposal. Nothing's off the table.
On the other side of the Capitol, the House of Representatives' Republican leadership is divided on how to proceed. But whatever actions Congress takes, the White House is already speaking of the nuclear accord as a done deal. Spokesman Josh Earnest noted that Congress's review period ends next week, saying, quote, "It will mean the international community can move forward with implementing the agreement." Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
On September the 11th, 2001, passengers on United Airlines Flight 93 overwhelmed terrorists who had commandeered that passenger aircraft and were planning to fly it into a third location after the Twin Towers in New York and the Pentagon outside of Washington had been struck in a similar manner. The plane crashed into a quiet field in western Pennsylvania. Now, 14 years later, an official memorial has opened for visitors to pay their respects to those passengers and their role in the tragic events of that day, 14 years ago today. VOA's Kane Farabaugh attended the opening of the memorial on Thursday and spoke with International Edition's Jim Stevenson by phone from Somerset, southeast of Pittsburgh. Kane talks about the many hurdles which had to be overcome to reach the memorial's opening, including the different planning ideas and the funding.
So even start further than that, acquiring the land to begin with was also a bit of a difficult task for the families of these victims to get through, you know, who owned the land, making sure it was actually safe to purchase. It's a former abandoned strip mine. All of these were considerations that had to be thought through before the land could be acquired for there to be a monument or a visitor center to be built on top of it. Obviously, funding has come into play. This is a private and public partnership. At today's dedication ceremony, that was pointed out, you know, there have been over 100,000 donors. Some have given pennies and some have given millions to make this all become a reality. But really leading the push through all of this has been the families of those victims that got on that airplane when it came down on September 11th.
It has been, an unofficial memorial since then with people just showing up.
Yeah, I mean, I was there on 9/11. I covered the events as these unfolded. I got there just about a couple of hours after the attacks happened. I've had some kind of a connection to this. I've visited this site, I would say, at least every other year. And I've been able myself to witness the progression of this from the scene of a tragedy to a makeshift memorial. The first year that I went back, which was just about 1 year after the attack, there was a chain link fence that was set up near a small wooden shack, which became a chapel. And inside this chain link fence, people who would come to visit the site, they would leave stuffed animals. They would leave combat boots, tokens of remembrance.
Now that the permanent memorial has opened, what are they featuring for visitors?
One thing that stands out is there's actual artifacts of the airplane that are on display. You know, there's pieces of one of the phones from one of the seats inside Flight 93. Also the recordings that the victims left their families. You can pick up a phone on one of these displays and listen to some of the last recordings these people that were passengers on Flight 93 made to their families to let them know what was occurring on that flight. Some of those are haunting and chilling, but I think it does leave an impression with you if you're a visitor visiting that complex.
It gives me chills just hearing you describe that and thinking about, these are the very last moments of these people who made a historic and very patriotic stand.
You know, it's one of those things, too, because on the day of 9/11, this was perhaps one of the more overlooked parts of the tragedy that unfolded on that day. Any other news day, the crash or the terrorist takeover of an airplane would be big news, regardless of how many people were on that airplane. But because this was part of a larger unfolding event, the circumstances surrounding the hijacking and eventual crash of Flight 93 wasn't very well known until weeks and in some cases even months after the event occurred. And when it became known that people on that airplane had found out what happened in New York and in Washington, D.C., rather than let the events overtake them, they decided, at least by the evidence that investigators had found after the crash, they tried to take over the airplane, and them trying to get into the cockpit is ultimately what led the plane into the ground.
As tragic as 9/11 was and how we remember it now with the Twin Towers and the Pentagon, it could have been quite a different story had those passengers not risen up.
That's right, and I think that is another part of the exhibit. This is another part of the hallmark of this memorial. It's the actions that these people undertook that helped prevent further tragedy on a day that saw so much of it.
It is a unique privilege for you to have been there right at the scene when it happened and through the years and see this evolve. And we thank you for sharing that with us.
Thanks, Jim. Always great to talk to you.
And you can see Cain Verbaugh's video of the new 9/11 memorial at our website. That's voanews.com. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. The fossilized bones of 15 members of an ancient species related to humans have been discovered in a cave in South Africa. International Edition's Ira Melman speaks with John Hawks of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, a senior author on the academic paper detailing the new species.
We have uncovered what is presently the largest collection of fossil hominin remains ever discovered in Africa. We have more than 1,500 specimens. They represent at least 15 individual skeletons of all ages, from infants up to very old adults. They provide for us an unprecedented picture of the biology of an entire population, and one that is, going to be an important one for everything that we do in our field from now on.
Is this the so-called missing link that scientists have been looking for centuries?
Homo naledi, it's really interesting because it has many features that are aligned with the features that we find in early Homo species, such as Homo habilis or early Homo erectus. But it also has many features that we find only in more primitive hominins, like australopiths. It's a transitional creature in that way. It appears to be related to us in our family tree around the time of those earliest members of Homo. And based on fossils from other parts of Africa, we would think that time was around 2 million years ago. But what we don't know is whether Homo naledi itself is a potential ancestor who lived around that time, or if bones that we've found represent a later time. Species don't become extinct, at the minute that they originate. They last for some time. And so Homo naledi, I'm not prepared to say that it's an ancestor. We don't really look for ancestors. What we do is we take the evidence that we find of relatives and work out from them what the ancestors must have looked like.
Well, there are some indications of this possibility, especially when you come upon the findings that these people or whatever, these creatures lived together and had some kind of societal makeup.
Yes, we find these bones in a very remote section of the Reisenstein cave, a section that can only be reached by traversing through a very narrow passageway that's a vertical climb. We had to recruit special archaeologists who had excavation skills, but also caving and climbing skills, And we're really skinny to fit into this very small passage that they had to climb down to get into the chamber.
And they were all women. They were all women, right?
All of our primary excavation team were women. We had a number of volunteers here from the community of the Cave Society who helped support us with safety in the cave. But yeah, our excavators were a team of young women, and they were extraordinary, risking their lives to uncover this amazing fossil find.
Now, this find was not made just yesterday or a week or two ago. It was a number of years ago. Is that correct? What's happened? Why just now are we learning about it?
Well, we discovered the cave first about 2 years ago, and we began to excavate fossils in November of 2013. At that time, we recovered an enormous number of fossil bones, and we recruited a worldwide group of experts. These experts were people with data sets that applied to different parts of the skeleton. We've never found a fossil assemblage like this and described it all at once before. So we brought in people who were experts in the foot, experts in the hand, in the teeth, and we allowed them to describe these fossils in great detail. That process, of course, takes time. And our papers that describe initially the existence of this new species and the geology of the cave in which they are found represent tens of thousands of person hours of effort. It is really a collaborative effort that has involved a worldwide team, and it's been, you know, just a great privilege to be involved in it.
Speaking from South Africa, John Hawks of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, senior author on the academic paper detailing this new species, he was speaking with International Edition's Ira Melvin.
Well, it's time to start the show. Lost my heart and lost my soul. Now it's time that you don't know. Lost my mind and lost my goal. Not giving in.
The group are rudimental singing Not Giving In. It seems an appropriate song for the World Suicide Prevention Day, which was recognized in more than 40 countries around the world on Thursday. It is a day set aside each September 10th in order to provide worldwide commitment and action to prevent suicides. International Association of Suicide Prevention collaborates with the World Health Organization and the World Federation for Mental Health to host the World Suicide Prevention Day. The WHO says a person commits suicide worldwide every 40 seconds. In other words, about 1 million per year. There's no doubt about it, an appropriate song, Rudimental's Not Giving In. Now let's look at what's being said on social media about World Suicide Prevention Day. Our Charlie Hansler is here with the latest. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Steve. Well, hashtag World Suicide Prevention Day is really, really popular. There have been over 18,000 usages of that hashtag in the past hour, according to Topsy.com, a social media analytics site. The extremely high usage of hashtag World Suicide Prevention Day really shows that suicide prevention is something many, many ordinary people really care about. In addition to its being World Suicide Prevention Day, it's worth mentioning that September is officially designated Suicide Prevention Month.
And Charlie, what kind of things are people posting with this hashtag?
Well, when you search hashtag World Suicide Prevention Day, you'll find many things tweeted out, but one of the most common things you'll see people doing are tweeting inspirational quotes to encourage people to hold off from committing suicide, as well as many people making short video statements saying essentially the same thing. There is also another popular hashtag being used in conjunction with hashtag World Suicide Prevention Day, which is hashtag Please Stay, which is meant to encourage people to keep persevering and not give in to harming themselves or committing suicide. British comedian Ricky Gervais tweeted from his Twitter handle, at Ricky Gervais, "It's hashtag World Suicide Prevention Day, and I think that hashtag Please Stay is one of the most moving, simple, and beautiful hashtags I've ever seen." This tweet by Gervais has been retweeted over 3,000 times. Thanks, Steve.
Amazing. Thank you to Charlie Hansler, keeping an eye on social media for us. By the way, if you'd like to follow International Edition on Twitter, you can find us at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Tough economic times in Greece are inspiring some creative business solutions. What was an empty warehouse in Athens is now a business incubator, a modern co-working space called Saveri 16. Co-founder and manager, Theodore Perkikakis.
The idea was to have a very different place that doesn't look Greek, yes, or Mediterranean. We wanted to be more international.
Common areas such as the cafeteria and meeting rooms are shared in the incubator, as are the bills for utilities like phone and internet. Christos Adignostopoulos, manager of the startup Athens.Taxi, likes to be able to collaborate with other firms in the building.
Let's say you might need some artistic work or some web design or some advertising, consulting.
Saveri 16, an idea to help small companies when Greece is facing widespread economic challenges. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexiou.
Hello, everyone. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. We're going to move along to a rather interesting story, I think. The U.S. National Football League Super Bowl game. Well, we all know about that game. Big, big game on television around the world. One of the highest rated television programs throughout the year. Well, we all know that at the halftime, they have this big show. It's as much a part of the as anything going on the field during the game. A big deal. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about who will be hosting the halftime show. It's Super Bowl 50 on February the 7th.
The Super Bowl halftime show has become a big part of the game itself. And now, the man who was on it just a few years ago is going to be doing that show for the 50th Super Bowl in February. Shauna, Bruno Mars has been on this before. It was just a couple of years ago.
Yes.
And now, for the Super Bowl 50 in 2016, he's not only the act, but he's also supposed to curate the show.
That's what we're hearing. So Billboard.com confirmed that sources have said that he's been asked to do it. Now, he has not agreed to do it, at least we don't know that, but yes, he is going to curate it. Now, from what I understand, that means that he will be a part of it, but he will also be responsible for bringing guests on. Now, you might remember when he performed during Super Bowl 48, he brought on the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and that's not uncommon. Very often, when an artist will come and do the Super Bowl, they'll bring their friends. Katy Perry brought out Missy Elliott, and Madonna brought out Nicki Minaj and MIA some years ago. So it'll be very interesting to see what he does. He's a consummate performer, and I don't believe he will expect anything less from the people that he brings on. So if he says yes, and I think he will, this is going to be an awesome halftime show.
This is that ice cold Michelle fight for that white gold. This one for them hood girls, them good girls, straight masterpieces. Styling, wildin', living it up in the city. Got Chucks on with Saint Laurent, gotta kiss myself, I'm so pretty. I'm too hot.
Well, plus literally billions of people worldwide watch this particular show.
Mm-hmm.
They watch the game, but the halftime show is as much a part of watching the game as watching the actual competition on the field.
Right. So, you know.
And for folks like me who couldn't care less about football, it is the reason why you watch the Super Bowl. So, yes, it is a very important part of the show.
And Bruno Mars also had a number one hit. He broke the record for having the consecutive weeks at number one with Uptown Funk.
Yeah, he and Mark Ronson with Uptown Funk. And so he obviously is someone that is adored and adored by fans and well-respected in the music industry. So it does make sense. And up until that point, he had had the highest viewed halftime show for the Super Bowl. Katy Perry broke the record the next year, but he held that record. He's, like I said, consummate performer. Never expect anything less than fantastic.
Well, we'll look forward to that. Super Bowl 50 is the first Sunday in February. You can look for Bruno Mars on the halftime show. You can also look for Shauna Renee on the VOA Soul Lounge. That's on our website, voanews.com. If you want to send her a tweet, she is at VOA Lady DJ.
Yes, indeedy, that Bruno Mars is something else. Listen, veteran music producer Emilio Estevan has written a song. It's called We Are All Mexican. It's to celebrate the achievements, he says, of Hispanic people in the United States. He says that the new track will feature his wife, Gloria Estevan, and Hispanic entertainers, including Carlos Santana and Wyclef Jean. Song will be released in conjunction with Hispanic Heritage Month, which begins on the 15th. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Political violence shows no easing in Burundi with the murder of an opposition party spokesman in the capital, Bujumbura. Patrice Gangu of the UPD Zigamibanga party was shot and killed outside his home September 7th, the second top official of the group slain in the turmoil surrounding President Pierre Nkurunziza's controversial decision to run for a third term. Other prominent Burundians have been gunned down in recent months as well, with no suspects arrested. 15 years ago, the spirit of the Arusha Agreement transformed Burundi by enshrining the conviction that the government must represent and serve all citizens. Today, Burundi faces a renewed challenge to end violence and achieve lasting stability by coming together in the spirit of Arusha. This isn't the work of one group, but of every person and party. We call on President Nkurunziza and his government, on opposition leaders, and on all the people of Burundi to join now in an open, comprehensive, and representative national dialogue. Nor is it a challenge for Burundi alone. The United States reiterates its support for regional leadership, including Uganda and the East African Community, to convene and mediate a political dialogue and urges them to do so soonest. High-level engagement by the African Union and the United Nations and positive action by all states in the region is critical to bring Burundi back from the brink. We also remain committed to holding accountable human rights violators and abusers and all those who seek to undermine stability in Burundi. President Nkurunziza is well aware of his nation's crisis and has called for security committees to work together with Burundi's security agencies. That is very worrisome, as it includes armed youth militia, including the armed contingent of the Imbonerakure, the ruling party's youth wing. Militia violence and intimidation have profoundly increased tensions and worsened a crisis that has driven almost 200,000 Burundians to take refuge abroad. To prevent further violence, armed Imbonerakure and all militias must be disarmed immediately with AU oversight. We call on all Burundians to oppose any further acts of unlawful violence and to join together now in the spirit of Arusha to reach consensus and a peaceful path forward for Burundi.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.